You're listening to Ryerson Broadcast News.
Thank you for tuning into Downtown Sound. We're recording live from Ryerson University. I'm Chelsea Shim.
I'm Wes Murray, and here are today's top headlines.
Premier Dalton McGuinty makes his decision on federal politics.
Italian scientists face jail time for failing to predict an earthquake.
And first, an update on the serial sex attacks in Toronto's West End. A Toronto judge has denied bail to a 15-year-old boy charged in connection with a series of West End sex assaults. Police arrested him Saturday with the help of female undercover police officers. There have been 14 assaults since mid-August. What does that mean exactly? Jason St. Jacques tried to find out.
For weeks, women in the West End have worried about a serial sexual attacker. But the attacker, a 15-year-old suspect, is now in custody and isn't a rapist. Constable Wendy Drummond explains that police have a pretty wide definition of sexual assault.
Sexual assault is any unwanted touching, and that can be anywhere from a kiss as far as and up to including penetration.
Why don't the police use more specific words? Rape, touching, flashing. Drummond says it's a very sensitive issue, and police don't want to discourage women from reporting any abuse.
Sexual assault is a situation, it's one of the most personal crimes, and we understand that there is hesitation in reporting these type of crimes, and sometimes there's a bit of a time delay when we issue a public safety alert. There is the potential for more victims to come forward.
But that's not how most public thinks. Bailey Parnell is a Ryerson University student.
Well, the police would say it's anything unwanted, any unwanted touching, but for me as a girl in downtown Toronto, I get just as uncomfortable when I have men yelling at me from across the street or following me home. So last year I actually did have to go to the cops because I had a guy that was following me home. I guess once I feel unsafe in like doing things that anyone would normally do, that's when I would go to the cops, I guess.
Police say that reports of sexual assault are down 10% from last year, in spite of the problems in the Christie Pits area. But they say that isn't going to make them any less vigilant across the entire city. For Downtown Sound, I'm Jason St. Jacques.
A woman has died in hospital after being stabbed repeatedly in the torso and arm. The attack happened early this morning in Cabbagetown near Wellesley East in Parliament. At around 7 a.m., people heard screams coming from the alley where the victim was being attacked. A witness said his friend used an umbrella to fend off the suspect who had a knife. Police confirmed the attacker was scared off by at least one other person.
Silence is golden, but not for much longer on the TTC. In the next 2 years, cell phone service could become available on station platforms. Councillors will vote tomorrow on a complex deal that would net the TTC $25 million. An Australian company would install service in 61 underground stations. The TTC says some commuters can hardly wait, but surveys show that others savor their few minutes of silence a day. And don't want to have to listen to someone else.
Speaking of the TTC has announced its Spadina extension project won't be completed before the fall of 2016. The $2.6 billion subway line was supposed to launch in December 2015. The TTC says it took longer than expected to agree on station designs, figure out how to relocate utilities, and get funding approvals. The Yonge University Spadina line is being extended 8.6 kilometers from Downsview Station to the Vaughan metropolitan area, with six new stations along the way.
Mayor Rob Ford says he won't tear down the Gardiner Expressway, despite serious safety concerns discovered by an engineering firm. For once, Ford and City Councilor Adam Vaughan agree. They say the 60-year-old highway is safe. Meanwhile, Ford seems more concerned that the city staff waited 6 weeks to tell them about the report.
Restaurant owners are being asked to weigh in on a proposed extension of the non-smoking ban. Toronto Council wants to force smokers to butt out on restaurant patios and in public doorways. Lauren Waltuter has the story.
O'Grady's Pub in Boys Town is packed on Friday nights. But manager John, so he claims, worries that his customers will disappear if they can't light up outside.
Going to lose my business just because majority of the people that do sit in the patio are smokers. If they see non-smoking, they rather prefer sitting on their own patio instead of coming to a patio on the street where they can't really smoke.
But Toronto's Medical Officer of Health, Dr. David McEwen, doesn't care about John John's problem. He says that patios are exactly what he wants to target in a proposed extension to the public smoking ban.
Patios is a place where other non-smokers and smokers congregate. That's where we can try to reduce the impact of secondhand smoking and reduce the impact of social exposure to smoking for young people and people who are trying to quit.
Yesterday, City Hall announced it will be asking restaurants and the public what they think of clearing out smokers from more public areas. And not all restaurant workers are against the idea. Omar, a waiter who declined to give his last name, says he's tired of being exposed to secondhand smoke.
For sure it's bad for us because we have to smell the smoke too. I would love to see no smoker on any public areas.
Even smokers say the changes could be better for restaurant goers, like this woman huddled under a pub awning.
I think that if you have places where there are people smoking and people not smoking and they're eating food, then it's preferable not to have smoking when you're eating your food. I wouldn't be offended.
Council hasn't said how long the consultation process will last. This is Lauren Waldhuter for Downtown Sound.
It's official. Dalton McGuinty announced today he will not run for leadership of the Federal Liberal Party. He says he's done with politics altogether. McGuinty said the key factors in his decisions were the conflicting timing of the federal and provincial leadership races and the long-term commitment required to rebuild the party. The Federal Liberals won only 34 seats in the 2011 election.
New Democrat MP Romeo Saganash is taking time off to treat his alcoholism. Air Canada kicked him off a flight on Friday, saying he was too drunk to fly. The flight from Montreal to Val-d'Or, Quebec, was delayed for half an hour as he was escorted off the plane. Saganash apologized to the other passengers and the flight crew yesterday. He cited stress and the death of his friend and mentor, Jack Layton, as factors contributing to his drinking problem.
XL Foods is trashing 1,800 recalled meat products. Hundreds of tons of beef were dumped at a landfill site near Brooks, Alberta. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency says the meat samples, in fact, tested negative for E. coli during a recent inspection. Wild Rose Party leader Danielle Smith tweeted the meat should be salvaged and used to feed the hungry. NDP leader Brian Mason responded that Smith is not taking the safety risks seriously.
In international news, yesterday an Italian court sentenced six scientists and one bureaucrat to 6 years in jail for manslaughter. Their crime? Underestimating a 6.3 killer earthquake in 2009. They were also ordered to pay almost $12 million in damages to survivors of the quake, which killed more than 300 people. The scientific community is horrified. Seismologist Tom Jordan headed a commission on the earthquake.
This particular prosecution is going to have a very chilling effect on scientists' willingness to kind of step out and try to communicate what they know or don't know about hazards to the public and to decision makers that have to take action.
The men are expected to appeal their sentence.
The final debate in the U.S. presidential race aired last night, and, surprise, surprise, commenters gave it mixed reviews. The main point of discussion was foreign policy, including Syria, Libya, and China. Flash polls suggest President Barack Obama won the debate, showing more experience. But many commentators agree that he and Republican candidate Mitt Romney are starting to sound a lot alike. Obama has become more firm and assertive, while Romney sounds softer, perhaps shifting focus to the female vote. The two apparently agree on key issues, including the use of drone strikes to kill militants, a commitment to Israel in dealing with Iran's nuclear ambitions. The winner on the social media front was almost definitely Obama, who got the internet buzzing with this comment.
Governor Romney maybe hasn't spent enough time looking at how our military works. You mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed.
One important thing missing from the debate was the European economic crisis. Environmentalists were also upset that no one mentioned climate change. Both candidates will now increase their travel and spending in a final race to November the 6th.
New developments in Gaza. The Emir of Qatar is visiting Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Hunir today. It's the first time a head of state has visited the coastal territory since Hamas took power in 2007. The Emir has promised $400 million in economic aid to Gaza. This is not good news for some other players, including Israel, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and Syria, Hamas's former patron.
A Taliban ambush killed 10 Afghan soldiers in the western province of Herat earlier today. 5 policemen, including the district commander, and 5 soldiers died during the combat. The Afghan troops were ambushed while searching for a group of insurgents who had set up a roadblock in the area.
This morning, the Vatican announced that it will postpone its delegation to Syria. A spokesman says that because of the gravity of the situation there, the peace mission will not continue this week as planned. A top police official was murdered in Beirut on Friday, and Lebanon is blaming Syria's government. Pope Benedict's Secretary of State, Tarsesso Bertone, announced the mission late last week.
And more Syrian news? Government forces killed at least 20 women and children in a bakery in Aleppo this afternoon. Video footage showed decapitated bodies and scattered bread loaves. Street fighting has continued on a daily basis ever since rebels tried to capture the city last month.
Indian officials submitted a clemency plea to India's president from a gunman in the 2008 Mumbai attack. Prisoner Mohammad Kassab was one of the 10 terrorists who killed 166 people in a 3-day attack. Kassab was sentenced to death in 2010 for waging war against India, murder, and terrorist attacks.
A resident at a nursing home in Taiwan has confessed to starting a fire that killed 12 people and injured 60. Hospital officials say the victim died of smoke inhalation. Many of them were bedridden and too weak to escape. The accused patient said he set fire because he was unhappy about his own illness.
At a world meeting yesterday, Canada's foreign affairs minister lashed out at Iran. John Baird called Iran's intolerance towards religious minorities unacceptable. He attacked what he called the country's hatred of Jewish people and its support for terrorist groups. He added that this is why Canada suspended relations with Iran last month. Delegations from Iran and Uganda accused Canada of interfering in their internal affairs.
BBC Newsnight host Jeremy Paxman is the latest person to clash with Conrad Black. During an interview that aired last night on BBC, Black called the host a priggish, gullible British fool, after Paxman called him a criminal. In the interview, Black mentioned he plans to return to a seat in the House of Lords. Lord Black of Cross Harbor was released from a U.S. prison last spring after serving 3 years for fraud and obstruction of justice.
A court martial in Esquimalt, B.C. has found a captain guilty of sex offenses against 2 teenage cadets. It convicted Captain Daniel Moriarty of sexual exploitation, sexual interference, sexual assault, and behaving in a disgraceful manner. The charges involved a 16-year-old girl and a boy who was 15 when the assaults began.
A New York court says lap dancing is not a form of art and does not qualify for a tax break. It says lap dances do not promote culture in the same way as ballet. The club Night Moves sued for exemption from sales tax under a clause that exempts music and dance performance. Judges who dissented the majority opinion said state law does not distinguish between highbrow and lowbrow dancing.
Fake Rolexes, fake Apple computers, fake Barbies, and now, fake ketchup. Yes, officials have found a fake ketchup factory in Dover, New Jersey. They were called in after hundreds of ketchup bottles marked Simply Heinz started exploding in a large warehouse. Simply Heinz is made with sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup. The operation was repackaging regular Heinz ketchup as the more expensive Simply Heinz. The heat of the warehouse caused the product to ferment and eventually explode.
The body of Lincoln Alexander is back in Hamilton today, so that his hometown can say goodbye to him. But his coffin lay at Queen's Park from Sunday afternoon until Monday night to let Toronto pay its respects. Gabby Rodriguez has the story.
Lincoln Alexander, or Link as he liked to be called, died Friday at the age of 90. He was the first Black member of Parliament and the first Black cabinet minister in Canadian history. He also served as Ontario's lieutenant governor from 1985 to 1991. Yesterday, he lay in Queen's Park's main foyer in a closed casket draped with the Canadian flag. Many of his memorabilia were on display in the legislature's main hallway. Alexander earned many medals and hats for his services to the police, firefighters, and the military. People lined up to pay their respects. Winifred Berry benefited from one of Alexander's countless good deeds.
I'm here today because of the kindness Mr. Lincoln Alexander had shown me in 1987. My daughter applied for an educational grant to go to McGill University. The grant was denied. I went to my local MPP and he was not able to help me. So I wrote Mr. Alexander a letter, and in less than a week, that grant was approved.
Gilbert Cardi met Alexander once while he was in office and was struck by the MP's character.
Right away, you saw the quality of leadership in him. Someone who you know, took an undivided interest in you when he spoke. Emitted a wonderful energy. He walked, you know, with majesty.
On the way to Hamilton late last night, the motorcade made a special trip down the Lincoln M. Alexander Parkway, named for a man who never did get his driver's license. Dozens stood on the Garth Street overpass to pay their respects. A state funeral will be held Friday in Hamilton. I'm Gabby Rodriguez for Downtown Sound.
That will be it for our news today. I'm Chelsea Shin.
And I'm Wes Murray. Stay tuned for current affairs.
Good afternoon, I'm Erica Agresia.
And I'm Nicole Servinus.
And we are here to guide you through the current.
Today we catch up with two experts who shed light on a controversial topic, the right to die.
Canadian law says you don't have that right. One of our experts thinks that's wrong.
We also have your top stories in health, sports, business, and entertainment.
Gloria Taylor was the first Canadian to win the right to a doctor-assisted suicide. Now, the BC Supreme Court is battling with right-to-die organizations and anti-euthanasia groups. Dr. Will Johnston is a family doctor in Vancouver who strongly opposes physician-assisted suicide. He appealed the court's decision and believes it sets a dangerous precedent. Nicole spoke with Dr. Johnston today to find out why.
I wanted to ask you if you could tell me a little bit about physician-assisted suicide.
Yes, right now, of course, the overwhelming principles behind medical care are to first do no harm and to always intend the well-being of the patient. And so physician-assisted suicide is a departure from this strong medical principle by suggesting that the physician should write a suicide prescription for the patient. And it unfortunately morphs seamlessly into euthanasia, where there's direct killing of the patient. Because in our rights-based culture, the moment the patient is not able to lift the poison to their lips themselves, there is a rights-based claim made that the physician should also be able to directly kill the patient at a time of their choosing.
Then is it still wrong to end someone's life when they're suffering and they're ready to die?
We have a medical system which pretty well reassures us that we're not going to die in uncontrolled pain. Symptom control at the end of life is actually very, very good. It's interesting that the people who take advantage of the assisted suicide law, for instance, in Oregon, where the little bit of information we know about Oregon shows us that people are not choosing to die because they're in uncontrolled pain. That is not the issue. People are choosing to die because they are afraid of loss of control, and they are afraid of pain, not necessarily that they're in pain. When we talk about choice, what we're really doing is we're enhancing the choices of the people who would arrange your death. And we have to really question whether your own choices, your own autonomy is going to be enhanced by giving more power to the medical system and to the people around you who could arrange your death. And this may not seem an issue to a person who feels totally on top of their situation, but I can tell you that there are a lot of older people in particular who take their cues very closely from the people around them and who are vulnerable to undue influence from people around them.
Would you say that was the case with Gloria Taylor when she declared the right to die with dignity, which is not outlawed?
This is our concern, that Gloria Taylor lived a life under a media spotlight. Every statement, every motive was closely examined. It's not likely that Gloria Taylor was under the influence of others and steering her towards the wish for suicide. And it is clear that at the end, she died quickly of an infection, which is a far more likely way for people to die than by committing suicide. She didn't need that change in the law to have the maximum life that was available to her. The fact of the matter is that the law is there for a very good reason. The difficulty in determining, for instance, whether a certain death was voluntary is magnified when someone standing beside the person's body can say, well, they meant to die. This was a suicide. I was only helping out.
Thank you so much, Dr. Johnston, for speaking with me today. I hope you have a good day.
Thank you for being interested in this problem, Nicole.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Russell Ogden is a criminologist and the director of the Farewell Foundation for the Right to Die. After extensive research, Russell believes that Canadians should have the legal right to choose death. His foundation seeks to support people considering suicide, but Russell says he never counsels or aids them in committing the act. Erica spoke to Russell to learn more.
Can you describe what you do as a supporter of those considering suicide?
Well, I've been studying this subject area for more than 20 years. In the course of that research, I've learned something. I've learned that there needs to be a more humane approach. You know, this is an issue of life and death. So about early 2011, four colleagues and myself, who are all like-minded, launched this nonprofit organization that we call the Farewell Foundation for the Right to Die. The foundation has prepared some rules that we call the procedures for attending at a self-chosen death. A self-chosen death is basically an unassisted suicide. It's carefully planned, and it's attended by compassionate people who will support people when they are dying, because we believe that nobody should have to die alone. These deaths are reported to law enforcement, and we now have a team with the foundation that will attend at carefully planned self-chosen deaths.
Now, why would someone come to you rather than go to their family or friends?
Well, people do actually go to their families and their friends for support, but sometimes families and friends are closed-minded to what can be a really difficult discussion. And that's where we come in. What we try to do is include family members and loved ones in talking about self-chosen death. Now, it's also true that some people come to us without family members. We have many members who are very, very old, and they are really quite alone after living a very long life. And so, again, that's where we come in. We can provide a compassionate sounding board for this kind of conversation.
And what do you say to these people who come to you?
Well, we let them know that we're in a position to hear them. We're not in a position to judge them. And we're also not in a position where we will impose any kind of will on them. So we're not going to make them live. We're also not going to make anybody die. We're really here to listen, to provide a compassionate presence, to be non-judgmental. And ultimately, if people do elect to proceed to a self-chosen death, we're prepared to attend at that and ensure that it happens in a way that is compassionate, that people don't have to die alone.
What do you say to those who say that what you're doing is actually promoting suicide?
Well, I would say that what we're doing is quite to the contrary. We are paradoxically a kind of suicide intervention or prevention. Many people who come to us are just so relieved at being able to have a safe and non-judgmental conversation. They feel better. They live longer. They are pulled back from impulsive kinds of decisions that they might make, and they're grateful for being able to have a conversation where they're not judged, where they can express themselves.
And what are the chances that the Canadian laws on suicide will be changing?
Well, I would say the chances of a change in law are very good. We've already had the BC Supreme Court rule that Section 241, which is the law that imposes an absolute prohibition on assisted suicide, unconstitutional. That case is proceeding to an appeal at the BC Court of Appeal that begins in March of 2013. But it's in the air, you know. We've had a lot of change in this country in the last couple of decades. We've had same-sex marriage. We've had enhancement of gay rights. So I think that the issue of the right to choose the time and the manner in which we can die is not that far away. I think the times are changing.
Okay, thank you very much, Russell. Have a good day.
Thank you, Erica.
If you're having trouble paying attention in class or at work, you may be considered taking ADD or ADHD drugs to boost your focus. But before you ask your doctor to write you a prescription, you might want to consider the very serious side effects associated with these drugs. Roxana Bekanu has the story.
So you're in a coffee shop, just hunkering down in a squashy chair with your coffee, getting ready to get some work done, when all of a sudden... Were you distracted by the coffee grinder? Or the loud laugh? No. Then the good news is, you probably don't have ADD or ADHD. But if you're not still with me, you could have attention deficit disorder. Statistics Canada says that 5% of Canadians have ADD. If you're one of them, you're also probably not going to get any work done at the coffee shop. Not with so many distractions. Unless, of course, you're already taking medication for the disorder. Peter Owen, a college dropout, has been dealing with ADD his entire life. But he's been taking Adderall XR on and off for the last 5 years. He says he only takes it when he has work to get done, because it has serious side effects.
From the on point of taking the Adderall, it is a very strong stimulant. There's no possible way you can sleep or calm down. Many, many days, I'd take it in the morning about 8 a.m., and I wouldn't be able to fall asleep until the next morning, probably around 2.
Colin Forber is a graduate in history from Waterloo University. His degree owes a lot to the combination of Ritalin and Concerta he started taking for ADD 7 years ago. Now, he's also stopped taking his medication, unless he's facing a major deadline for his research work. The reason? Also terrible side effects.
My emotions were dulled, my appetite was dulled, I didn't feel like myself in any way.
Both men are now taking Adderall XR, which is the mildest drug of the bunch, and only when they face special stresses. In fact, they both have techniques they use to focus without the help of drugs.
Recently, I've been using caffeine, which is a very similar mental stimulant to Adderall. It doesn't have the physical effects, but the mental effects which are needed, caffeine does deliver.
Whenever I have something that really needs to get done, I take very occasional doses of like Ritalin. Adderall is the other one.
But Adele Garrigus, the pharmacy manager of Glendary Pharmacy, says occasional use isn't a great idea. The ADD and ADHD drugs have to be taken correctly in order to work.
Usually it has to be taken at the same time every day with a certain dose. The people sometimes find that if they get higher dose, they get better. This is not the idea.
He says that patients and parents should communicate more with their doctors and pharmacists. That's the only way to get rid of the unwanted side effects. But he admits that doctors should be better informed about the risks of the drugs they prescribe. Garrigus says people should be particularly careful with stimulants and antidepressants like these.
Most of the antidepressant medication may cause depression. This is fact. There is no certain kind of antidepressant does not cause depression.
A Toronto Star investigation led by David Bruiser found that a lot of children on ADD drugs are suffering from extreme side effects. They include delusions, mania, and depression, sometimes so severe it can lead to suicide. The drugs involved are Ritalin, Bifenton, Concerta, Strattera, and the list goes on. This naturally has parents worried and frustrated. Sandy Owen is Peter Owen's mother.
Oh, that'd be horrible. I can't imagine being a parent and having that happen at all. It's just, that would be really, really hard to live with. There are other forms, I'm sure, of non-medication that would be much, much better for children with ADD.
But Garrigus says that if doctors prescribe these drugs, it's still his job to make sure patients know the risks. He also believes that some patients should consider medical supervision to make sure they find the drug that works best for them. Bottom line, if something feels off, it probably is.
So we advise the first week, for example, they may have certain side effects. It's understandable because the medication does not give the full power unless after 4 to 6 weeks. So yes, we advise the patient that you may have side effect, please tolerate it. If you are not able to tolerate it, in this case, go back to the doctor. He may adjust or change the dosing.
Until more is known about why these drugs can produce such different results, Adele says communicating any problems to your doctor is essential. He says one of the biggest mistakes people make is stopping their treatment on their own.
Don't increase it or decrease it or stop it completely without doctor advice.
It can be frustrating to try out different prescriptions until one works. But because different people react differently to medications, it's the best idea until you find your own way of dealing with the ADD or ADHD. But people like Peter and Colin say they'll be playing it safe for now and not taking medication at all. Peter has found that caffeine and meditation work for him. He says that he appreciates his doctor's opinion, but ultimately, what goes into his body is his choice. The medications just weren't a good fit for him. I'm Roxana Becchianu for Downtown Sound.
Coming up in health, stay off the sweets. One report suggests that a sugary diet can make you stupid. Monster energy drinks may be linked to 5 deaths. Angela Hoyos has this story.
This is Angela Hoyos with all of your health headlines. Even if you have a sweet tooth, you may want to think twice about devouring that sugary treat. A report out of UCLA suggests that consuming sugar doesn't just make you fat, it can also make you stupid. Neurosurgery professor Fernando Gomez Pinilla says a high fructose diet disrupts the brain's cognitive abilities, and that leads to poor learning and memory retention. Research has already proven that sugary diets can lead to obesity, diabetes, and a fatty liver. And more good news. It's fall, that wonderful season that brings warm sweaters, falling leaves, and influenza. But this year, many people are planning to pass on getting their vaccinations. Roxana Bouchineau has the story.
Well, it's that time of year again. The flu is back in town and infecting as many people as it can. Everywhere you go, you hear coughing, sneezing, and noses being blown. So will you be getting the flu vaccine this year?
I've never taken it, never bothered to, and I've been all right.
I think I've only gotten my flu shot like maybe twice in my life. So, I mean, I didn't get it last year or the year before, so I don't really see the point.
The free vaccine will be available at vaccine clinics across the city starting October 25th. But a lot of people are passing on the shot this year.
I don't think it makes a difference, actually. I really don't. I know people who have gotten the flu with or without the shots.
There's even more mixed feelings about the shot among healthcare workers. Camelia Modran is a registered nurse. She thinks healthy adults don't need the vaccine.
So no, it's not you have to. Depends on the individual if they choose to. No, you don't have to have it. It's not a must. Depends on the individual.
But the Ministry of Health is pushing for immunization. It says children under 5 and adults over 65 are at a greater risk of developing flu complications and should be getting the shot. The ministry's Dr. David McEwen says the annual immunizations are important to protect people around you who are in the risk group.
If you have a parent or a relative or a neighbor who is more likely to get sick and die from the flu, then it's a good thing for you to get immunized so you don't pass it on to them.
One thing both McEwen and Modran agree on, if you work in a public environment, you should be getting the shot. But if you do choose to pass on the shot, Modran recommends getting enough rest, avoiding stress, and washing your hands. I'm Roxana Becchianu for Downtown Sound.
Thanks, Roxana. It's energizing, it gives you adrenaline, but could it kill you? The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is investigating reports of 5 deaths that may be associated with Monster energy drinks. Monster is being sued by the family of a 14-year-old Maryland girl with a heart condition. She died after drinking 2 cans of its Monster energy drink in 24 hours. Monster says its drink was not responsible for the girl's death. Cover. Parents, you may want to take out that Xbox and TV from your kids' bedrooms. A new study from the University of Alberta found that children who go to bed with one or more screens in their bedrooms are more likely to be overweight. The study surveyed over 3,000 grade 5 students in Alberta. And that's it for your health news. Thanks for tuning in.
In sports, after winning the deciding 7th game and their 6th elimination game in a row, the San Francisco Giants are headed to the World Series to face the Detroit Tigers. Shipping off to Boston, former Jays bench boss John Farrell was introduced as the new manager of the Boston Red Sox today. Lance Armstrong is no longer a 7-time Tour de France champion. Nurudin Kurani gets the cycling community's reaction to Armstrong's fall from greatness after being found guilty of using performance enhancers.
That should end it. And who else? Scooter Rowe. And the Giants have won the pennant.
That was the call last night from Joe Buck as the San Francisco Giants took the NLCS away from the St. Louis Cardinals in the seventh and final game of the series. Matthew Cain and the Giants bullpen shut out the Cardinals' heavy hitters in the pouring rain and sailed to a 9-0 win in Game 7 against the defending World Series champs. Giants second baseman Marco Scudero recorded 14 hits in the series, which was enough to earn him the MVP title. With the win, the Giants are set to face the Detroit Tigers in the World Series. Game 1 starts on Monday in San Fran. Sticking with baseball, the Boston Red Sox introduced ex-Blue Jays bench boss John Farrell as their new manager today. Farrell was pitching coach in Beantown from 2007 until 2010. The deal saw pitcher David Carpenter join Farrell in Boston, while the Blue Jays acquired versatile infielder Mike Alvarez. But now, let's take a look at some younger athletes. Hundreds of competitors at the London Olympics were teenagers. Our own Shannon Kuzes has the story of one even younger athlete who hopes to get to the Olympics as early as possible.
It starts as a dream that takes hours of hard work and dedication, a dream that millions chase and only few achieve. But those few athletes who turned their Olympic dreams into reality say it was the best moment of their lives. At 8 years old, Emma Pimentel is well on her way to becoming an Olympic gymnast. Since the age of 2, she has quickly moved from recreational to pre-national level. Her coaches see a spark in her, one that successful athletes tend to have.
I saw the Olympics, and I really wanted to do it. I was thinking maybe one day I could be one of those people. Mostly like the USA and China and the Canadians.
Emma trains 5 days a week. On top of that, she has been competing since the age of 6. Emma's mom says she lives and breathes gymnastics, especially when the Olympics are on. The recent London Olympics are a good example.
She was just so into it. There were like 6 or 7 other kids in the at the cottage, but she was just so determined. And everybody was getting ready to go to the beach, and she's like, I'm not going to the beach, I'm watching this. And she was just watching it, and then at the end of it, she just aspired to be one of those girls.
While she is only 8, that aspiration might not be too far away. The youngest ever Olympian was a 10-year-old Greek gymnast, Dimitrios Laundris. He won a bronze medal at the 1896 Olympics. But today's age restrictions mean no one that young can ever compete at the Olympics again. In 1996, the International Federation of Gymnastics raised the age limit for the Olympics to 16. This was to help protect athletes from potentially dangerous injuries. Nonetheless, athletes around the globe are preparing to peak by starting early. Emma's coach Amanda, a former competitive gymnast, knows the importance of training young.
We look for young athletes, so we ideally like for the girls to start at about 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old. And the reason for that is because building the fundamentals for the sport at a young age helps them with their long-term success. It teaches them about body awareness, it builds strength and flexibility at an age where they're really too tiny to do a lot of skills. It's difficult, it's very, very hard to convince parents to do the hours when kids are that young, but you know, those that do see the long-term potential and understand that, their kids really like just have a safer, healthier, longer career in the long term.
For Emma, training 22 hours a week seems to be paying off. She is encouraged to eat fruits, vegetables, and protein to stay competition ready. Emma says she gets nervous before she competes, but so do the Olympians, so it's okay.
I like getting medals. It's fun when you like get more. I like setting records. It's fun when you beat them and then you get another one and you reach higher.
But behind the success is support. Emma's parents pack her lunches, they help her with homework, they drive her to and from practices, and they watch her competitions on weekends.
It was really, really hard at first to just get accustomed to the new schedule. But then now I think we got the flow. We got it working out. You know, she does 4 hours a night when she's training during the week, and on Sunday she does 6 hours. So it was hard at first, but I think we're used to it now.
I'll pick her up before gymnastics, and we'll spend like an hour working on homework and stuff, and then she'll come to the gym. And then she'll train, and she'll come home, and she'll wash up, maybe get cut up in some more homework or whatever, and then off to bed. Next day we do it all over again. We kind of have this cycle now where it's good.
This cycle is key to Emma's fast improvements. Her parents' teamwork make it easier to work with Amanda on a daily basis.
We're here to support her, and we are just in love with watching her go through her dreams, something we really didn't get to do as kids. So we're living through her, and it's amazing to watch how fast she's grown and how much she's loving it and excited to see where she will go with this.
Emma's dream is not even that far away. Hundreds of athletes at the London Olympics were 15 years old. More than 30 others were even younger. So even though Emma has to be 16 to compete for Canada as a gymnast, she could already be halfway toward making her dream a reality. For Downtown Sound, I'm Shannon Kouzis.
But not all athletes qualify as role models. Today, Lance Armstrong essentially disappeared from the history of competitive cycling. Downtown Sound's Nerdine Kurane checks out the reaction of Toronto cycling community.
UCI will ban Lance Armstrong from cycling, and UCI will strip him of his 7 Tour de France titles.
So boom, Lance Armstrong is no longer a 7-time Tour de France winner. He was officially stripped of his titles and banned from the sport yesterday. Members of Toronto's cycling community are not surprised. Doping has plagued the professional cycling for many years. Mark Romesil raced competitively from 2004 to 2010. He thinks cycling will ride out this scandal.
And I think that cycling in North America will have taken a hit, but I think cycling is a sport internationally. It's going to keep on going. This isn't the first doping scandal. He's not the first legend to have fallen.
Armstrong never tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs, but his decision not to fight the charges against him are widely seen as an admission of guilt. Mark Romeril.
Regardless of his admission or not, guilty. But I think people just want to hear him say it. They want to put him up, make him bleed, make him grovel, just like everybody else that comes out and writes a memoir about how they doped and how they feel terrible about it. For me, it doesn't matter if he explicitly admits his guilt or not, because he's just as guilty in my mind.
And Armstrong isn't alone. This morning, Stefan Carjard, one of Armstrong's cycling teammates, also admitted to using performance-enhancing drugs. For Downtown Sound, I'm Nerdine Kurane.
Thanks, Nerdine. And now in hockey news, the NHL lockout hits day 38 with both sides holding strong. The NHL has canceled 135 games so far this season, and you can bet there will be more. Since the lockout, AHL farm teams are gaining some well-deserved attention. The Toronto Marlies season ticket sales and attendance have skyrocketed. The Marlies travel down the QEW to face off against the Hamilton Bulldogs on Friday night. Puck drops at 7:30. That's it for sports today. I'm Dylan Ricola. Thanks for joining us.
Today in business, interest rates are at a standstill. Ottawa makes an important takeover decision, and Toronto vacancies continue to drop. Good afternoon, I'm Shannon Kouzis, and here's your business update. The Bank of Canada is softening its position on raising interest rates. It is leaving the benchmark rate at an ultra-low 1% for the 25th consecutive month. In other national business news, the Malaysian oil and gas company, Petronas, is appealing Ottawa's recent decision to block its takeover bid for Progress Energy Resources. Our own business reporter, Mike Duncan, has more on the story.
The decision was a shocker. Last Friday, Ottawa blocked a $6 billion takeover of Calgary-based Progress Energy. The bid came from Petronas, a Malaysian oil and gas company. The ruling sent stocks tumbling. Robert Mark is the director of Canadian investor firm McDougall, McDougall & McTeer.
We don't really have a proper sense of what the government is trying to achieve here, you know, like what their true reasons for doing this are. But I think on its face, I think there's still a high possibility that this will get approved.
Federal Industry Minister Christian Parody said the deal did not meet the government's criteria for a net benefit to Canada. Petronas had demanded 100% ownership of Progress Energy. Laura Lau is the Senior Vice President of Toronto Investment Fund Manager, the Brompton Group. She says Ottawa is putting future investment in Canadian companies at risk.
It definitely deters future investment. So that's why the government realizes we do need foreign investment, because, you know, what Petronas would put in is liquefied natural gas and oil sands. They're all multi-billion dollar projects, and Canada simply does not have enough money to do it by themselves.
The government has granted the two parties an additional 30 days to amend their proposal. I'm Michael Duncan for Downtown News.
Here in Toronto, vacancy rates are lower than they have been in decades. As the demand for office space continues to rise, so does the cost of rent. Net rental rates are now just below the record-setting levels that led up to the 2008 recession. But some prices are falling. You might have noticed that fueling your car has gotten cheaper in the last few days. Well, experts predict gas prices may drop even lower. By the end of the year, they expect to see 99 cents a liter in the Toronto area. This would be the first time winter gas prices fell below the dollar in 2 years. On to technology. If you thought the iPhone 5 was the latest trend, think again. Apple is set to announce a pint-sized version of the iPad tablet this week. The new product is expected to fill the gap between the iPhone and the existing iPad. And finally, Tim Hortons hopes to reduce lineups with touchless debit. Interact Flash will be placed at 2,300 Tim Hortons locations across Canada by the end of the month. The new system allows customers to put their cards in front of a scanner and pay directly from their bank accounts. And that's your business update. Until next time, for Downtown Sound, I'm Shannon Kouzis.
Today in Arts and Entertainment, Latino advocates crying foul over Disney's latest princess. The sizzling Iron Man trailer finally drops, and we take a look at the latest Bond film. We also have the scoop on this year's International Festival of Authors. Here's Brian Boudreau with your weekly culture fix.
Disney is in hot water with Latino activists over its latest princess, Sofia. The Hispanic-influenced princess will star in the made-for-TV film Sofia the First. But Latino advocacy groups are unhappy about her blue eyes, red hair, and fair skin. Disney stands by its latest addition to its royal repertoire, saying she has a mixed heritage. In less controversial news, the International Festival of Authors is running at Harborfront this week. Jackie Hunter has the scoop.
Last night at the International Festival of Authors, nominees for the Governor General's Award for English Fiction read from their works. But it wasn't an entirely happy occasion. One of the nominees, Tomáš Dobuzi, said he had to struggle even to get his novel, Siege 13, published.
It was rejected by a lot of places. It already had an American publisher. I'd pretty much decided that that was it. I wasn't going to try anymore.
Nominee Robert Huff revealed that the international success of his previous novels has yet to spread to Canada.
Like, I've sold a lot of books outside of Canada, but I've never actually had a book kind of catch on in Canada. I think Dr. Brinkley will be my first. My first novel sold more copies in Poland than it did here.
A prestigious award like the Governor General's isn't enough to guarantee sales these days. But Dobuzi says it's still a great time to be a Canadian writer.
There is no longer any anxiety around what is Canadian literature. That's when a national literature is actually starts to bloom.
The Governor General's Award winners for English fiction will be announced next month. For Downtown Sound, I'm Jackie Hunter.
Okay, enough highbrow stuff. Marvel has finally released the first trailer for the much-anticipated Iron Man 3.
Nothing's been the same since New York. You experience things. And then they're over. There's 100 people who want to kill me.
Lesson number one. Heroes. There is no such thing.
The last voice is the Mandarin's, one of Tony Stark's most formidable enemies. But eager fans will have to wait till May next year to witness the epic showdown. 007 fans have a much shorter wait, with the latest Bond feature arriving in theaters next month. Skyfall promises a return to the classic elements of the Bond franchise, which is celebrating its 50-year anniversary.
Just look at you, chasing spies. England, the Empire. MI6. So old-fashioned.
Everybody needs a hobby.
So what's yours?
Resurrection.
Fans of the British MI6 agent should check out TIFF's Designing 007 exhibit at Bell Lighthouse, which gives an inside look at the films over the years. Well, that's all, folks. Until next time, for Downtown Sound, I'm Brian Boudreaux.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Downtown Sound's Current Affairs. I'm Erica Agresia.
And I'm Nicole Stravinas. We hope you join us next week to ride the current with us.